This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your tablet, smartphone, and desktop. Support the show and get a free audiobook of your choice by visiting audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by TrekFan. TrekFan isn't just a Star Trek fan club, it's a challenge. You will explore new places, learn new things, and collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles, complete real-life mission objectives, and win great prizes. And in the spirit of an enlightened future, TrekFan is absolutely free. Not just free to play, but completely free. Find out more by visiting fm.trekfan.org.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Follow Standard Orbit, Mr. Chekhov, and take us home.
Hi, sir.
You will obey. It is the word of Landru.
Joy to you, friends. Welcome to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated show about the original Star Trek series. This is a show where we dive into the characters, concepts, cliches, and other things that don't start with C about the original series. My name is Drew, or Landru. I'm the TOS editor for the network. And with me today is my co-host Mike from Commentary Trek Stars.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. And very special guest star, con expert, John Tenuto.
Hi, guys.
Thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it. Now, we did a Space Seed commentary, like a month or two ago, and now we're finally returning for our second commentary, This one on the Wrath of Khan, I guess you could say.
We're going to rap about the Wrath of Khan.
Yep.
The Wrath of Khan.
So we're actually going to be watching the theatrical cut of the movie, which is the version
Drew is an idiot. Yes, I know.
This is the version which is on the Blu-ray, and then it's also on Netflix and the original DVD release. So you can find it in any of those places. If you only have the director's cut, because you know that's what makes sense.
It's not in the box set. I'm sorry. I didn't think about it.
Okay, whatever. If you only have the director's cut, that's fine. Just whenever you get to a scene which we're not talking about, pause it for a few seconds and then, you know, whatever. Or just don't watch the movie while you're listening to us. That works perfectly fine.
Hey, everybody. We split this commentary in half after recording. This half of the commentary runs with the movie from 13 seconds to 1 hour, 2 minutes, and 48 seconds. Just as Terrell is saying how Khan went wild on the regular one scientists. 20 seconds of music has been added to warn the listener when the split comes.
So if you guys are ready, we'll get started. We are starting just after the Paramount logo fades to black completely, which is about 13 seconds in on the Blu-ray. I imagine it's similar on the Netflix and stuff and the Laserdisc. So if you guys are ready, we'll give a countdown and start it up. Ready?
All right, ready.
All right. 3, 2, 1, start.
Excellent. Paramount Pictures presents.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're watching it on Laserdisc, let us know, because that's awesome.
Yes. So, okay.
Imagine John has it on Laserdisc and DVD and Blu-ray all at the same time, and he's going to point out the subtle little differences we've never noticed.
Yes, I have all the versions. Even if I don't have the format, I don't know the format for a laser disc, but I still have it because it's great. It's like a record.
Yeah.
I've got my friends brought me the first disc of the motion picture on video disc.
Oh wow!
Wow!
Like the analog laser disc thing that
one
existed.
That like ran off of like a needle or something like that.
Right. I just have the first disc though, so I don't know what happens afterward, and I don't have a laser disc or a video disc player to do it.
So even though this is the theatrical cut of the movie, we've already seen one change to it from what was originally in theaters, and that it says Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan instead of Star Trek: The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, this is the music people would be hearing if they were listing to it is of course by James Horner, who is, you know, one of the big themes throughout the whole film is that the movie was originally going to be produced by the TV side of Paramount. They weren't quite sure whether this was going to be a feature film or a TV movie of the week. In fact, it originally started out as a TV movie of the week. So a lot of the people that worked on it behind the scenes were really TV people given their first chance as the production went along, and they realized what they were getting back and what they had, and what, you know, as things were turning out that this really needed to be a full blown motion picture. You know, you get a lot of people who worked on TV, and maybe had never worked on films before, or had only worked on a few films, like James Horner had only done a few, or there's Gain Rescher's title on the screen as I'm looking at it there. And he was a Emmy Award winning TV cinematographer, and this was his first motion picture. So a lot of the names that are familiar to us now, when Star Trek II ran in theaters, we were watching it in 1982, a lot of the names were unfamiliar, or if you were familiar with them, it was from the TV side of things. And that goes along with Nicholas Meyer there, whose credits on the screen, with his idea that art thrives on limitations, that if you have too much money, too much time, too many special effects, unlimited resources, it may squander a kind of opportunity and creativity. And I think this film's a great example of that.
Yeah, I've always been curious about that, because I've heard that, you know, this originally was maybe not intended to be a TV movie, but that was certainly an option which was on the table. And I was curious as to when it was decided to make it a theatrical motion picture, because, I mean, they shot it in anamorphic widescreen, which is something that you would never do if you were planning on showing it on television. Do you know when that happened?
Yeah, before the cameras rolled was the decision was made. In fact, it's pretty interesting. One of the documents that we have from our research, my wife and I, is the budget as it was with television, and then the idea of kind of skirting over to do it as a film, and then how the prices increased. So, you know, Captain Kirk's civilian outfit that he's wearing, you know, when he's opening his birthday present, you know, was originally a couple hundred dollars on the TV side and bumped up to like $3,000 or $4,000 on the movie side. So when it was on the TV side, it still had a pretty healthy budget. It was budgeted at around $7 or $8 million. So it was still a pretty heavy budget, but when they moved it over to the film side, you know, everything increased, and so the budget went eventually to about $11 million, still a third of what Empire Strikes Back cost. And you know, there's even, you know, we can get into it as we go through, but there's so many cost saving measures that they took. One is that, you know, the Klingon footage that you just saw was from the motion picture. Why not reuse it? You know, anything where they could save money, they did, because in the 80s, you know, big giant science fiction films were costing, you know, $20 and $30 million, and this was only about $11 million.
Mm-hmm. So here we have the Kobayashi Maru test. I think it's a really good cold open to the movie. Definitely had me fooled when I was watching it for the first time.
Is it true that they added this to, like, kill Spock right off just because the spoiler had been released?
Well, there were, you know, many, many versions of the script. The first sort of written document for the movie was an outline by producer Hart Bennett in 1980, actually. That was called The War of the Generations, which is interesting considering Next Generation's, legacy. But in that story, Kirk, there's a rebellion on a Federation colony. He goes there, Kirk and the Enterprise. There's no Spock in that outline. It's not even a script. It's a couple-page outline. But he rescues Carol Marcus, whose son is David, who's, you know, Kirk's son also. And he's the leader of this rebellion. And what they find out is that the true power, like, behind the rebellion is Khan. So David joins with Kirk and they defeat Khan. And that was the original kind of genesis, excuse me, for the story. But the first script was written by Jack B. Sowards in 1980, called The Omega System. And there's some similarities. Khan uses spiders instead of eels. Carol Marcus was Dr. Janet Wallace from the Deadly Years episode, the original show. Deadly Years, right? Yeah, sorry, yeah. And And the actress was, you know, the actress who played her in the original show was going to play her in the movie. Khan has mental powers, you know, in addition to physical powers. And most importantly, in that draft of the script, Marla MacGyvers is alive. But Savick is in there, and Savick's a male in that script. There is kind of a test sequence, a training sequence that's in that script. One of the interesting things was the Reliant was a Constitution class ship, and they realized right away they needed to make the ships look different, you know, when they actually got down to writing the scripts. But so the idea of putting a scene like this was there pretty early. There was the idea in one of the versions of the script, Spock dies in the middle of the film. And really everybody kind of rallied against that idea because you wouldn't have been able to recover from that. And so you still had an hour to go in the movie. It was sort of a psycho death, you know, where you don't expect it and it was going to be in the middle. And but they decided against that, eventually moved the death sequence to the end where it was in all of the Meyer versions of the script.
Was something like that line right there where he says, "Aren't you dead?" Was that added late in the process, like after?
Well, that's all that sort of tongue-in-cheek Meyer humor, you know. That's all the really good lines here come from Nicholas Meyer, and you know that's just sort of playing a little bit. Yeah, I mean it's a tweak at the audience. That sequence certainly does disarm you if you went into this film having heard rumors that Spock was going to die, and that does function. Not only to introduce the Savick character, who is intended, especially in the scripts, they're not necessarily in what was filmed, but certainly in Meyer's script, the big one is like from September 25th, 1981, and that's the one that's very close to the movie, but there's a lot in there that isn't filmed or was filmed and edited out, and Savick was had a much bigger role because she was really going to replace Spock. I mean, that was the intention of that character. And so, but you know, he's playing with you here where you're disarmed now. You think, oh, okay, see that they got it wrong in the newspapers and Spock's going to survive. And you kind of go along with the film then.
So as someone who remembers seeing this theatrically at the time and who was a huge Star Trek fan back then, like, I'm curious, had you heard the rumors and did you believe them? And when you saw that, you know, I guess when you saw that sequence, did it do its job? Were you like, there's some doubt in my mind now as to whether or not Spock is actually going to die in this thing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it really was, you know, you got to, well, you know, when we put ourselves back into that time frame with no internet, no source of information, honestly, other than the official fan club newsletter that or magazine that Dan Madsen had, and you know, fanzines, and there were some good fanzines out there. In fact, Mensa has a fanzine, for Star Trek Mensa members, and they had a relationship. The woman who ran that had a relationship with. Her name is Val Jagger, and she had a relationship with, the Star Trek II production company. And so they were, you could get news in places like that, but really Starlog, of course, but there was no, you know, there was no internet. There was no, you know, gossip, the TMZ type things. Pictures beforehand were much more easily controlled. And so, you know, it was easier to fool an audience in a way, back then, or you know, hide something from the audience back then. And so, you know, certainly when I saw it, I had heard that Spock was going to die. There had been a big, very big article in the Wall Street Journal in October of 81, so a good, you know, 6-7 months before the film's out, actually written by Steve Sansweet, of all people. who's the big Star Wars collector. And it was a whole article about fans taking out a ad in the Variety magazine, you know, basically telling Paramount, if you kill Spock, like we heard you're going to lose X amount of dollars. They had done the study. And this whole article was about that. And it's interesting reading the article because he got a lot of the details right. about the film. There were some things that were kind of off or scenes that were moved around. And actually Leonard Nimoy saw that article when he was in China filming a movie. And that was sort of his first inclination that there was going to be sort of a controversy about this. So, you know, it was certainly out there. And you could find out that Spock was going to die in major newspapers and things like that. But in terms of getting confirmation and all of that, no. So I think that scene really was a stroke of genius to put that there. And if you had heard about it, it kind of assuaged your fears. And it helped, what it really did is it helped you sort of forget about that and get lost in the story and not focus on whether Spock was going to die or not.
As a fan back then, were you one of the people who was like, if Spock dies, you die? Or were you like, hey, man, you know, this is a story. There might be a legitimate reason to kill this character. And, you know, let's wait and see what they do before passing judgment.
Well, you know, I was just excited to have another Star Trek movie. I mean, the first film was... You know, again, putting it in its time, not thinking of it in context of the other five, you know, the other five original films that make up the six. You know, it was enormous, that first film. It was grandiose. It was, the special effects were, you know, frankly, as good or better than Star Wars in many instances, and despite all the problems that they had. I mean, they had the whole film was big and enormous. But, you know, of course, everybody sort of felt a little bit cheated on the character side of it. You know, it was kind of special effect focused, and it wasn't really, the characters didn't quite seem right. And, you know, it was much more a 2001 movie than it was a Star Trek movie in a way. So it was great that there was the first movie, but I think there was a lot of fear, at least I had a lot of fear, that, well, that was it. They did the movie, it's done. Star Wars had really, you know, it was still going like an unstoppable train. So it sort of seemed like, well, Star Trek. And then you started to hear, you know, oh, it's going to be a TV movie. And it's, you know, that it was a motion picture, I was just thrilled with. And you know, again, the whole idea that we were going to have, you know, 13 films and all these franchises. We weren't thinking like that. I was just happy to have a second film. And if that was it, that was it. But it was great to have a second movie. And of course, when it came out, it was not only everything that I hoped for, it was everything Paramount hoped for, right? When the movie premieres on January 4th, 1982, it premieres as the number one film of all time. It beats Empire Strikes Back. It was the biggest opening ever for a movie. And, you know, it got huge critical, you know, acclaim and success, and fans were, you know, most, not every, but most fans were really happy with it. So, and they handled the death well. So, I never had a problem with it. I was just sort of happy we were getting another movie.
It was June 4th, 1982, just for the record. Now you were there, obviously, right? Opening day. Now, which theater did you go to? I'm a big theater geek, especially for Chicago theaters. Which one did you go to?
I went to the Esquire Theater.
Yeah.
I don't even know if that is that still around.
Thankfully, no, because they completely destroyed that theater. It became a... Anyway, so back then, it was, if I'm not mistaken, it was it had a balcony and everything like that. That was like when it was one screen, right?
Yeah, it was a one screen, so we got to see it in, you know, all its glory.
70 millimeter, I'm sure.
I mean, it's really, going to see the film, not only is a wonderful memory with my dad, I mean, my dad and I went to see it, and you know, it was, so it has a special place in my heart for that reason. But it also really introduced me to fandom. I mean, the reaction of the crowds, I remember being in the bathroom before the film, and people were talking in the bathroom like it was, you know, Picard's ready room, you know. it was just a back and forth and yelling and screaming and excited and happy and, you know, debating and everything like that. And I was like, who are these people? Like, you know, what is this? Who, you know, there are people that are excited about this like me, you know? And so I, you know, it was interesting to kind of just observe that whole, the whole environment of the people that were there and the film and the audience reaction and the, you know, it's sort of lost in today's world a little bit. I mean, I you know, certainly I go see films on opening day, but in some ways it becomes a, you know, it's a simulacra of what it used to be. You know, I mean, it's the seventh time we're seeing the Star Wars film on opening day. You know, it's not like those first times. Everything else is just sort of a redo and a rehash. And in many ways, this whole idea of going on opening day back then was just an unusual thing to begin with. You know, that kind of, you know, sort of starts with in science fiction, you know, and at least with you know, films like 2001 and so on, going to see it on opening day. But not, it wasn't like that was part of film history, you know, to do that sort of thing as fans.
I'm wondering what the lurking variable is there, because when I heard that this was the movie which at the time set the record for the highest gross on opening day, that just did not compute with me, because I just don't see how it was a larger gross than the motion picture, even, you know, on opening weekend, and definitely I can't see how it would beat Empire Strikes Back. And I was thinking about it and thinking about sort of like my own personal experiences with it, and like the biggest phenomenon which I could see in recent years, the biggest jump was from Batman Begins to Dark Knight. And the only reason why I think that really happened, like such a substantial increase, was because of Heath Ledger, you know, and the fact that he had passed away shortly before the movie was released. And I'm wondering, do you think that that was part of why that opening weekend was so big, was because everyone had heard that, you know, Spock had died? I mean, obviously it's a fictional character instead of an actual person, but... You know, do you think that had something to do with, you know, the reason why this was such a big success right out of the gate?
Oh, sure. You know, the I think there's a series of reasons that came together. One was, you know, does he or doesn't he? Certainly Spock, to the general population then and now, is the face of Star Trek. And so... you know, him dying, it would resonate even with the sort of casual fan or the person who sort of watched it, you know, on TV and, you know, reruns and things like that, who may not have been necessarily a committed fan. And then, you know, it had Ricardo Montalban. We're seeing him here in his, this is actually the first scene he filmed, when the Botany Bay scene, his first appearance in the movie is also the first scene, that he filmed. And, you know, he's bringing in an audience too. I mean, just, you know, the film going audience, you know, this was his return to movies, and he had an audience, fan base from Fantasy Island and his own films for, you know, since the 1930s, really. And, I also think a big part of it was the word of mouth. I mean, there was, you know, from critics, almost universe, and critics like Pauline Kael and Roger Ebert, I mean, big critics, telling people to go see this film. And I think that all those things kind of come together, along with the sort of built-in Trekkie audience that existed, that helped push this film into the $14 million, which today, of course, that's you know, that's a pre-sale, you know, but back then that was a huge box office, that $14 million that they made.
So now we're finally into Khan, and, so he never takes off his right glove. Whose idea was that? Was that like a costume designer thing, or was that Ricardo himself?
Well, the costumes were designed by Robert Fletcher, who we had actually asked Nicholas Meyer a couple questions about the costumes, and we asked him what place do costumes have in film, and he had a great answer, which was, you know, that they were shorthand to character. And so he gave the example of Lawrence of Arabia, whose army outfit is ill-fitting, to symbolize that the army was ill-fitting to Lawrence, you know. And Ricardo Montalban talked about the costumes, that the costumes really helped him figure out who Khan was at this time. That these were, as you can see on the screen, these were prince's robes that had been tattered and destroyed, you know. So Robert Fletcher really deserves a lot of credit for his work on this film. And in fact, Nicholas Meyer had given him two kind of directives. One was he wanted new uniforms that were in the spirit of Prisoner of Zenda. So if you go back and look at that movie, the 1956 movie, you see an awful lot of similarity in the costumes. And also that he wanted it to have a sort of naval feeling, because Meyer felt that this was Horatio Hornblower in space, not even realizing that that was also one of Gene Roddenberry's conceptualizations or foundations for Star Trek, was Horatio Hornblower. So he actually mentioned a joke that I thought was great, this idea that the uniforms and especially the uniforms of Starfleet being naval influence. He had said his wife had called them nautical but nice, which I thought was a great joke, you know. But the costumes were really one of those areas that Meyer had some freedom in, because, you know, there's certain things that he was given by legacy. You know, you're getting Ricardo Montalban, which of course is a great, great person to have, but, you know, all the actors are the same. The Enterprise is the same. I mean, there's certain trappings that had to stay the same, but there were other things that could change. And one of those were the costumes. And so costumes were really important to the film, to the characters, especially to Khan there. The idea of keeping the one glove on was Meyer's idea. And he's never explained why, what the reason was. And he's promised never to explain why.
Awesome.
His reasoning is that whatever you and I think as the audience as to why Khan keeps that on is as valid as his reason. So what happens, you know, he talks about this, what happens when you say, no, this is what I meant. That shouldn't negate what the audience interpreted. So he's joked about what it meant. You know, he's given joke answers, but he's never given a real answer as to why, you know. So you're wondering, is there an injury there? Is there, you know, is it just something that's sort of strange enough that it makes you off put, you know? In sociology, we have the idea of, when you create a, you know, like a tough guy image, one of the things you do is mess with symbols. You know, you wear your hat in a weird way. You wear sunglasses inside. You know, things like that where the symbol becomes unreadable makes the person scary. And so by not, you know, when are you going to take that damn glove off? Why do you have that glove on? It just makes you nervous, you know? It was a brilliant, just little things like that. You can add a lot to the character with a little item that, you know, could have easily just been taken off, and 30 years later, we wouldn't have been talking about it, but here we are.
This was the scene that, as a kid, scared me away from watching this movie in the first place. You know, I had heard about this, and I was like, I don't want to see this. This freaks me out.
Still, yeah, that's a big cardboard. It's a big sort of cardboard styrofoam ear that was blown up, a big giant one, about a person tall, half a person tall or so. And that's how they did that sequence. You know, it was not even a real ear. Hmm. If that helps anybody listening now is still scared.
Well, they weren't looking, so now that's not going to help.
Right, that's true. That's true. This is an interesting, in this sequence here, this whole Botany Bay sequence, there was a baby that was filmed that was going to appear twice in the movie. That was the first time the baby was going to appear. The idea was that Chekhov sees this toddler's face, this kid's face in the porthole outside, and they see a crib in the Botany Bay. And that's, you know, that, you know, so obviously there's people there, and it's sort of meant to just put you at unease, like what's going on. And that was removed when the second sequence with what's known as the Khan baby, but it was not ever Khan's baby. It was one of Khan's people's kids. Well, we could talk about later on when that second scene was going to be there, but when they removed that second scene, they also removed that scene, but they did film that, that moment. I have the sound file of that. Somebody from Italy has the sound file, but that scene has never been shown on deleted scenes or anything, but it was filmed.
Wow, that's really cool. Yeah. So this, a lot of this footage is stuff which was reused from the motion picture. And To me, it always, more than anything, I thought it kind of was a perfect example of the power of editing and how, you know, you can take footage and cut it together in a different way and make it, you know, much more effective in some senses, you know.
And a heck of a lot shorter.
Yeah, that's true. Speaking of scenes being shorter, this is right around the time of one of the additions to the director's cut. There's a lot of stuff with the midshipman first class Peter Pressman that's not in this version.
Yeah, that's real fast. If you're looking right there when he's saying, "We'll see you there, sir," there's a kid with red there who's the tallest of the kids on the same line as Peter Preston there. That actor is Todd Bryant, who plays Claw in Star Trek V. Just throw that in there. But sorry about that. Peter was supposed to have a much bigger role so that his death was more effective. And then, of course, it was established that that he was Scotty's nephew. And so he was given a little bit more of a line, you know, more lines here calling, comparing Kirk to Tiberian bat, you know, blind as a Tiberian bat, that kind of thing. So, yeah, it was one of the things that was put back in when Nicholas Meyer took another pass at the films for the DVD. There's Todd Bryant again. He's all over this film. He's, you know, it's sort of the same five. There he is, you see. There he is. Yeah. It's the same, like, six or seven cadets in the scenes.
Yeah, I can kind of see the resemblance, you know, the forehead and whatnot. What do you think about the changes that were made? I know there are a lot of people who think that the stuff which was put back in kind of doesn't need to be there. I personally like it myself, but what do you think about the director's cut?
Well, you know, I kind of agree with Nicholas Meyer that, you know, you don't, if you're, well, you know, it depends. I have to say it depends. He sort of felt when you put the film out, it's done, you know. But there were things that you could do, choices he would have made had he had control over the final edit. And so there's nothing, he didn't do any extravagant redo, you know. It was not an episode, you know, a Star Wars situation or anything like that, or remastered Star Trek or anything. Although I thought remastered Star Trek was brilliantly done. So, you know, there isn't anything I think that's distracting in a way. You know, there isn't a big, you know, the Enterprise isn't doing barrel rolls, or they're, you know, they didn't create a new explosion or anything like, you know, anything like that. It's all character stuff that was put back in. And I always like that. I like seeing that. It would have been in there if he had the ability to, you know, release his edit of the film initially, or, you know, so I think like Star Trek VI, where he put in the flashes of the people. When Spock is mind melding and they're naming the conspirators, and they put that in, it's a small thing, but it really adds to the film, especially for, you know, somebody like my parents or someone who are watching it, who don't remember who, you know, the Romulan ambassador Nonclus is, you know, but when they flash it, then you go, oh yeah, okay, it's that guy from earlier in the movie. And so I think those are the kinds of changes he added here. You know, Preston's death doesn't mean anything, unless you have the context of who he is. And so I think by putting in more of that Kirk and him had an interaction, that isn't, not in this version, but in that helps with the character. So he added all character stuff. And I think that's great. You know,
now, if I'm not mistaken, a lot of that footage was added into the television version of the movie, right?
Yeah, that was the first time we got to see some of those. That was when you got the different edit of the elevator scene, you know, where the dialogue is the same, but whether it's a two shot or a one shot changed. So there was the first time we kind of got a pass at seeing what would have been added was in when they did show it on TV. I think it was on ABC, if I'm not mistaken.
Was everyone like, "Oh my God, look! Look, new scenes," or did people?
Yeah, because we were. Yeah, yeah. Oh my gosh, yeah, because we weren't used to that at all. It was, You know, Superman had done that. Superman, when it showed on TV, showed for 8 days, 4 hours a day. No, I'm kidding. But they showed they showed Superman over two nights. It was a 4 hour extravaganza. You know, I mean, they were adding like a half an hour, 35 minutes worth of footage. I mean, that was incredible. And you know, we didn't have DVDs and stuff back then, and even videotapes. So really, that idea of being able to see those bonus scenes, or to, you know, like when they re-edited The Godfather for television, it was an event to watch it on TV back then. And, you know, by adding those kinds of scenes, it made it more special. Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh my gosh. It was days and days of talking about it afterwards. Sure. I'm still talking about it now. There was Jetta, who was played by John Vargas, and I've never been able to confirm this, but I always thought that character was, it's only a guess, but I always wondered whether or not the character was named in honor of the Jedi. So.
I love this set with all the blinking and the flashing and the Genesis device itself. It's so primitive. I mean, looking nowadays, you know, at how much information we can fit inside our iPads or whatever. I just love the big metal cylinders. Like, is that information, or is that some kind of locking mechanism? It's like, it's just technology for technology's sake, and I love it.
Yeah, it's great. The sets were all designed by Joe Jennings and Mike Miner. Mike Miner, huge important person to Star Trek. He worked on the first film. He worked on the second film. He worked on the original show, even though he was very young at the time. He did Loskeen and the Tholian web. He figured out how the Tholian web could be made for television, which was a astounding special effect at that time. He designed the helmets of the redesigned spacesuits, you know, when they moved from sort of the shower curtains to more like a regular spacesuit. You know, he designed the helmet for that. Mike Miner was sort of all over Star Trek, and he was all over Star Trek too. He helped design the Reliant. He's the one in the original, in that Jack B. Soward's version of the script, the Omega system, the Genesis was called Omega, and it was a planet destroying weapon the Federation had designed. And Miner had said, you know what, the Federation would never design a weapon like that. You know, so it was Miner who suggested they call it Genesis, and was the one who suggested it be a terraforming device that could be perverted into a weapon. So, and then of course he did the sets. So him and Joe Jennings did phenomenal work on the motion picture. He was an apprentice to Matt Jeffries back in the original show. And so he worked on Star Trek The Motion Picture, got nominated for an Academy Award, redesigned. He was the one who really helped redesign the Enterprise for the movies. And so all the sets that you see, you know, those are just egg cartons and like packing cartons in the back there on the elevator, and they spray painted them. You know, they're brilliant. They didn't have a lot of resources, and they created some wonderful sets. A lot of credit has to go to the art department and to the camera operators. Craig Denault, who moved the camera, Gain Reshner, who was the cinematographer, Kathy Coulson, who also was, worked with the camera on this film. She starred in Twin Peaks, but she was behind the scenes person at this time. And, you know, the 65% of the film is shot on the same set. It's the Enterprise Bridge. But because of set redesign, changing the way the camera moves, changing the lighting, all of that, it looks like two different ships and makes the film look much bigger than it actually is.
In a lot of ways.
They're Skyping right now.
Yeah.
And they are.
And that's how Skype is, actually. That's how it basically works for me. I'm just kidding.
It is kind of interesting, like, you know, the sort of like looking at the parallels between, let's say, Nicholas Meyer and now what we're seeing with Roberto Orci, where, you know, Meyer had, I know, directed one movie before and Orci hasn't done any. And there's a lot of people who are sort of critical of the decision to hire Orci as the director for no other reason than that he's never done it before. And looking at this movie, I can kind of see how this would be a bit more suited to a inexperienced director, in that it really does give you a chance to just sort of play with the art of directing, as opposed to being bogged down by, you know, massive set pieces and visual effects and all that stuff. I mean, like you're saying, 65% of the movie is shot in the same scene, but at the same time, that's like a whole new set of challenges, because like you're saying, you've got to find a way to make it look fresh and distinct from what you had just shot. And that can be difficult when you're confined like that.
Yeah, that's that limitations, you know, spurring on the creativity idea of Myers. I think, one of the things I think any new director has to do, and I think, you know, he had directed a film before that. He's certainly written movies, had been a storyteller in one way or the other, is to approach directing like it's just a storytelling. So this may have been his sort of second feature film as a director, but it was not the second time he told a story. And I think that's part of a good director, is being a storyteller and knowing how to tell a story. And I also think being willing to take suggestions from people when you're a relatively new director, or frankly, relatively new in anything in life, to listen to other people. So that great moment at the start of the film when Kirk appears, you know, and he's backlit and, you know, just a fantastic first appearance of the character, you know, that was something that I believe Robert Salen, who was the producer, thought of. And seeing, knowing a good idea when you see it, Nicholas Meyer took that idea and used it. So, you know, you if you listen to the people around you, to their suggestions, that doesn't mean you always take them, but that you are open to people having a better idea. I know that was what many of the actors and the behind the scenes people said about this set, that the Star Trek II set was a place where anyone, the lighting person, Leonard Nimoy, could go up to the director, the producer, and say, what if we did it this way? And they might say no, they might say yes, they might try it, but it was a collaborative effort. And I think, hopefully that those kinds of ideas will carry on into the new Star Trek film.
I mean, just in general, even without being a first time director, you know, the idea of being able to listen to the ideas of your collaborators is really important. And it seems like the collaboration on this one pretty well, because like a lot of the key crew members who worked on this were then brought on to the day after to work with Meyer. So it must have been a good relationship, you know?
Oh yeah. You know, and of course this was a chance for them to really showcase what they could do, you know, to with limited resources, to be able to produce something that's of this quality. That, by the way, is Nicholas Guest, who's the brother of the director and actor Christopher Guest.
Oh, wow.
He's one of the ones I call the cadet faces. There are certain cadets they always go to for a reaction shot, you know, so that you, because they keep that theme alive through the whole, you know, really through the whole film, right? I mean, everybody's got kids. Spock has a symbolic daughter. Kirk has an actual son. Khan has a symbolic son or a real son, depending on who you want to believe. Here you could see the two of them together. And the Enterprise has children, right? The cadets. So, I mean, it's the whole, that theme carries through and that's there. But yeah, I think that, Nicholas Meyer deserves a lot of credit. He certainly, you know, the script is his script, and, you know, of course it pieces together elements of previous versions too, but this is really him, you know, his words in a way. He deserves an awful lot of credit for really saving the franchise, him and Harve Bennett. behind the scenes, all the people who worked with them, who went on to work with them on other features and TV movies, and of course the actors. I mean, just everybody was, I think, you know, did their best, and it shows. You know, really shows.
That was something that I was going to ask you about. Is, you know, I mean, obviously, we all kind of know the story with, you know, Jack B. Sowards was credited with the screenplay. But, you know, Meyer did a substantial rewrite. I mean, you've read, a lot, if not all of the drafts of this thing. Would you say that Sowards deserves screenplay credit? Like, or like, how would you, I feel like I've asked you this before.
Yeah, no, I do. I think, you know, I certainly there's beats within the film that are the same. So, I mean, it's not, he certainly, I think what it should have read was, you know, Nicholas Meyer and Jack B. Sowards or whoever they, I don't know exactly how they work that in Hollywood, you know, who goes first or whatever. But, you know, the some of the themes of the film are evident in the Sowards drafts. You know, there was another draft that was done by Samuel Peeples, who actually did Where No Man Has Gone Before, the second Star Trek pilot. In 65, he wrote that, and that was called The New Star Trek, and that was, you know, that was wildly different. That there's no Khan at all. There's two characters named Sojin and Moray. Terrell, there's no Terrell. Terrell, basically what Terrell does in the film is Sulu plays that role. There was a polar bear looking alien called Thal Actos, of course, because we need one of those. And then Carol Marcus has like a little Rubik's cube that follows her around. That's like Tron's bit, you know, yes, no, yeah. I mean, it's really different, really, really different. And that one, there's not a lot of that survived, but even in that one, it was Peoples that switched Savick over to a woman. So there's little pieces that are, you know, even in the versions of the scripts that just, you know, wholesale were discarded in a way. There's little elements that kind of come in, into the final version of it. But really what Myers did was Meyer took the best portions of those scripts and then created this whole thing around it. So, you know, and he did so, I think, in if I have my timeline right, just something in like 10 days, which is just incredible. No one thought he could do it. You know, it takes people months and months and months to work on, rewrite these scripts. And then he turned it around within less than 2 weeks. So, you know, it's, but I also give him credit. He said he knew that if his name was going to be on the film, that would have produced a delay that may have stopped the film from being produced. And so he gave up the credit he really, really deserved for his script. You know, his name only, you know, you'll see his name on 4 and 6, you know.
Yeah. So the scene, if I'm not mistaken, that was the first CGI sequence in movie history. Is that true or not?
I believe it's certainly one of the first ones, if not the first one. Also a unique use of sound too in that scene. I remember seeing that in theaters and it was disorienting. Anybody who's never seen Wrath of Khan on a truly big screen, not just on the big screen in their home. And luckily it's a film that they kind of, a lot of theaters, you know, if they're doing retro things or whatever, they'll show that. I think they showed it at, I think the Music Box, if I'm not mistaken, like a year ago or something like that. So it's something to always watch for, you know, and to see that on the big screen, that is so disorienting. It was amazing. Never seen anything like that before. I mean, it was so good they used it in the next three, you know, each of the next films, you know. We're not giving that scene up, we're using it, you know. And they show that to you. But the sort of sound effects, if you want to call it music, that plays over that was done by a man named Craig Huxley, who was a child actor who acted under the name Craig Hundley, who plays two characters in the original Star Trek. He played Kirk's nephew, Peter, and he also played one of the children, and then The Children Shall Lead. And then he went on to do, became famous for really mixing sound and music together. He created something called the Blaster Beam, which is really the voice of V'ger that you hear in the first movie. And then he did that kind of bizarre, interesting sort of sound effect music you hear playing over the Genesis effect. So he also had a long history with Star Trek too.
I did not know
Star Trek also instead of Star Trek 2.
Peter Kirk invented the blaster beam sound effect.
Right. Peter Kirk is responsible for V'ger, right? He had a horrible childhood. Parents, father was killed
by his fault.
Pancake, and he created V'ger. I think that's what I said.
I'm going to say this over and over again, but this is my favorite scene.
This is
big happy fleet. It is kind of great, like just in terms of the strategy and everything. Like I always thought it was really cool how you've got this where, you know, the Enterprise, you know, just gets pummeled, and then Kirk uses his experience and everything to outwit Khan and turn it back onto him. And there's just something which I've always found so cool about that, just the strategy involved in everything, and also, you know, sort of like the choreography of things and stuff. It's a really, really well done sequence.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's so many things to say here. I mean, you're looking at the same set, you know, you just looked at a few seconds ago, you know, and it doesn't look the same at all. I mean, it's amazing. Just the lighting.
It's interesting that the bad guy's ship is lit well, because mm-hmm. you'd expect it to be the other way around.
Yeah, it's smart, you know, in a way. It sort of plays with your expectations, you know. It goes against the symbolism that you would normally associate with good and evil, you know. And just even that. I mean, that special effect. Now you look at it still looks great, but I mean, back then, that was really, again, ILM, at their best in a way, you know, when we're working with models and, just the leaps and bounds that Empire Strikes Back had put them through taught them so much that they were able to produce these kinds of sequences, with the spaceship battle. So, I mean, outside the ship, it's great. Inside the ship, it's great. And here you really get that naval feel, you know, the bulkheads coming down and the language of the scene here. It's funny that when people were talking about whether or not John Harrison was Khan in the new film, one of the things they said that, well, one of the reasons it couldn't be is because he was wearing a Starfleet outfit. But, you know, when you look at the bridge of the Reliant, they're all wearing, I mean, Khan always, in each of his appearances, wears something Starfleet, right? Where he got the belt buckle he wears around his chest, we don't know. But, he has that. His crew wears the jackets. He wears the jacket of Starfleet in this film. He wears an engineer's uniform in Space Seed. So that's part of the character, is his almost taking a trophy in a way. From the people that he defeats, and I love that. When Kirk undoes the flap, there's an example of the costume helping to give you some character, you know, and adding to the character. And that's something that the costumes do in Prisoner of Zenda, that they come down like that. And what Meyer wanted the costumes to have pockets, because he wanted the characters to be able to put their hands in their pockets, but they didn't have the money to make pockets because it would have been too expensive. So in lieu of pockets, we get the casualness is the flap coming down, which I think is great.
Yeah, the flap is really what sells it to me. I always thought that was sort of a great reflection of the character's state of mind, in a sense. You know, you could tell, you know, how a person was feeling or what position they were in terms of their arc or whatever by whether or not their flap was down, you know? Even when it was used to, like, great effect in, like, Star Trek VI when, you know, Bones rips open his flap and everything like that to express, you know, disgust.
Frustration.
Yeah, frustration. It is great. I always loved, like, in the mid-90s or something like that, for whatever reason, the baseball uniforms that the White Sox were wearing were made by Wilson, and they, you know, were button-up jerseys, and they were black jerseys, but the inside was white. So there would be times where, like, a couple of the players, they'd wear it with the first couple buttons undone, and you could see the white underneath. I'm like, oh, man, that is the best ever. I've always wanted one of those so I could get my Star Trek White Sox jersey, but unfortunately they don't make them like that anymore.
This was great too, because this is something I think the new films, I hope that they, the news out this week is that the third film is going to be more reminiscent of the original show, whatever that means. But, and, you know, one of the things I think that defines Star Trek from the very beginning, from Corbomite Maneuver, Balance of Terror, certainly seeing that here, is that Kirk needs to be on the bridge and uses his mind. You know, this argument that existed, I think it's gone away now, but that somehow Picard used his brain and Kirk used his brawn or whatever, that's so untrue. Kirk is as smart as Picard, maybe smarter because he's dealing with primitive, in a way, you can call it primitive situations a little more often. This is a great example of Kirk using his mind to defeat his enemy and being on the bridge to do that. There seems to be a hesitation to have Kirk on the bridge in the new films. You know, he isn't there a lot. And really, none of the resolutions to the stories occur there. And I think that that this is a great example to two times in the film where Kirk is on the bridge and he kind of bests Khan, you know, using his intellect, which is obviously pretty substantial if he's able to defeat Khan, who is, you know, brilliant by superhuman standards. It helps to have Spock. It helps to have Spock there too, you know.
Yeah. It took me years to realize, I mean, like, someone had to point it out to me that Kirk and Khan never meet.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's all through view screens and stuff. I mean, I never really realized that. And it's brilliant. In the new movies, they would be trying to figure out a way to drop the Reliance shields so that Kirk could beam over and punch Khan in the face.
Yeah, in fact, what's doubly amazing is they're not even acting to each other here. So
yeah, that's
Shatner was not acting against Montalban. He was acting against a script person who was reading Montalban's lines and vice versa. You know,
I hope that he was doing an impression.
Kirk, you have one. You have a minute. Well, you know, there was in the September 81 version of the script written by Nicholas Meyer, there was a scene where the two of them meet. And that scene was to occur. There was no Khan yell in that script. Mm-hmm. What you got was a scene that plays very, very closely to the Kruge Kirk fight in Star Trek III. What happens is, you know, Kirk is taunting Khan, saying, you know, if you want Genesis, you're going to have to come down here and get it. And he does that. He shows up. And he has swords with him, you know, old-fashioned swords, not lightsabers, but old-fashioned swords. And he challenges Kirk to a fight. And McCoy basically tells, in fact, I have the dialogue as it would have been if you guys wanted to hear it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yes.
Yeah, Khan's on the ship. And he says, you know, I'll blow this planet into cinders and you with it. Kirk says, he's in the cave. Says, if you do that, you'll never have Genesis, Khan, the ultimate power. Then Yalcom says, and I'm not joking, he says it exactly, it's a trap, sir. I don't know if he says it like that. He says, it's a trap, sir. He's baiting you. And Kirk says, I dare you to come and take it from me. And Yalcom pleads with him, in heaven's name, sir, let us repair the ship and leave this place. And Khan says, I could retrieve the coordinates from the space laboratory transporter room. I could beam up the entire Genesis project without you. And then Kirk says, do it. I'll give you the coordinates. You'll get nothing. I've disarmed the device and hidden the encoder. That's a lie. That's a ruse. Khan says, you challenge me. And Kirk says, the winner takes Genesis. So Khan beams down. Khan says, winner takes all as the challenge party. The choice of weapons is mine. Kirk says, naturally. Bones says, you remember how strong he is. And Kirk says, all too well, this is not going to be a contest. You know, he knows he's going to get defeated. And Khan says, where is the device? And Kirk says, behind you in the tunnel. Are you ready? Khan says, I was ready long ago, Admiral. I've been ready for eons. My wife was ready, too. Kirk says, I'm not responsible for the death of Lieutenant MacGyver's, Khan. You are. And Khan says, are we fighting or chatting? then the two of them fight. And then that's where he says, revenge is the best revenge, wouldn't you say? The encoder, where is it? And Kirk says, you'll have to kill me. And he defeats Kirk. And of course, there's no encoder. So what happens is Khan then just leaves him. He abandons Kirk because he's going to punish him. So basically, then he's back on the ship. So literally that whole sequence, while it would have been cool because they would have been together and fighting, was not necessary to the story because they wind up in the same place at the end of that scene. And what you don't get is the emotional payoff. The emotional payoff is the fight between the two of them. Now the emotional payoff is Kirk yelling Khan, which is just, you know, I can't imagine my life without that moment in my life, you know. and so that is a great example of them. They never filmed that. And that was a great example of them knowing what would work and what was a better option. And the better option was to never have them meet and to have them always having verbal and intellectual fights. Let the ships pound each other. The two of them, would fight intellectually and fight verbally. I think by editing out that scene, I also think that's wise because I think you would have had a lot of people, comparing that to Star Wars, because you've got, you know, even though there's swords, it's still a sword fight in a science fiction film, and it would have been an unfortunate comparison in a way. Of course, they would have acted way better than I read those lines, and it would have been much more interesting. But I'm glad it wasn't there in a way, because we get the better moment, which is the two of them having that interchange that they have, that where the emotional payoff is the Khan yell.
It does seem like a very TOS thing to do, though, the primitive type of sword fight, you know, Squire of Gothos and that kind of stuff.
Oh, sure, yeah. You know, and it does.
But
put
I,
the
do
two
like,
characters
I do together. Like the intellectual battle more, but I think that, you know, if I was on staff back in the day, I would have pushed for the sword fight.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's how how does Lex Luthor fight Superman? He either has to get a Kryptonian armor suit by himself, or you fight Superman with your mind, you know, and you fight him intellectually. You give him some challenge, like two missiles going in two different directions, you know, that kind of thing. And so I think in some ways Kirk has that same dilemma. You know, physically he's no match in a way. I don't know how he beat Khan in Space Seed. No one knows what that tube was that somehow met. You know, I mean, it's a fight that shouldn't have resolved that way in a way. Like it does in Space Seed, considering how strong Khan is supposed to be. It's a moment that, you know, where if they were together, they would have had to have been physical with each other, and it's probably better they weren't physical, you know. But yes, I do see that where, you know, you'd want to have them fighting like that. By the way, this scene here with the arms, the way they did that was those are just stunt people. They're being held by their feet at the top where you see William Shatner right now. Originally, there were just other people holding them by their feet so they could film that scene. And then you actually, we have pictures of William Shatner helping up the actors back up there so that they can continue filming. that scene, the stunts in the film, which are pretty substantial, and many of them spectacular, were done by under the supervision of a man by the name of Bill Couch. In fact, when Kirk even does this right here, when he punches this, that's not William Shatner's hand. That's Bill Couch's hand punching it. But Bill Couch not only performed the stunts, showed him how to perform the stunts, showed him how to do that. You know, how do you punch that panel? I should say it's Shatner, but he was trained how to punch the panel, broke breakaway glass, and all that kind of stuff. Bill Couch's family was a dynasty of, and still is, of stunts. And Bill Couch's brother was Khan's stunt double in the space seat episode. So it's kind of neat. But it's weird because Bill Couch was the stunt double for Shatner. He was also the trainer, so he would train Shatner how should you punch this so you don't get hurt, you know, this glass. He worked on the fight sequence with him and Merritt Buttrick, and he also was Khan, so he was both, you know, the stunt coordinator, but also did stunts and did the stunts of the two main actors, you know, the good guy and the bad guy in the film. So Bill Couch did a lot of great work on this movie.
Well, thanks for listening to the first half of our commentary, The Wrath of Commentary. It's really fun talking with John Tenuto. It was so much fun that, it took the length of a movie. But that's not the only thing that we've been talking about on Trek FM this week. So here's what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
They're not going to just do something crazy and be like, what if we did Star Trek, but on Earth? What if we did Star Trek, but, you know, with more explosions or whatever? Wouldn't that be cool? And giant robots.
Earl Grey.
Between a combination of Riker's beard and the spandex, you could pretty much identify what season you were watching just by those two markers alone. No beard Riker? Must be season one. Pinstriping in the background, but Riker has a beard? Must be season two.
The Ready Room.
The Prime Directive is there, and all these captains are constantly having to break it because it's obviously such a rigid rule.
Right.
And you can't tell a story with such rigid rules. So you go back to, it's television, it's drama.
The Orb.
It's never clear, like, is Costa Mojan, is that the name of a person from long ago, or is it the name of a group of people? And so you're saying that in the Prophet's language, Costa Mojan is the name of the Paw race.
Right, that's what they call the Paw race.
To the journey!
Think about how horrible it would be perceived by the audience to see Neelix beaten up ruthlessly.
Some people would really enjoy that.
That's true, I'm talking about normal people with hearts and souls. Okay, so those people.
Commentary, Trek stars.
This means that really now, sort of, the three of us are responsible for really getting the movie to what it's going to be, and there's a feeling, okay, what the movie we write is the movie that's going to get made, which is a really cool feeling, actually.
Warp 5.
You know, Spock and Tuvok are two Vulcans, and so I feel like if you brought 10 more into the room, to say that they're all going to be the same is really a boring race. It's, even right. If they're logical, they shouldn't have the same personalities.
Melodic Treks.
But when J.J. Abrams came on, he was like, just in like casual
t-shirt and jeans.
T-shirt and, yeah, and because he'd just come from the set of
Star Wars.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good excuse.
Continuing mission.
And there's this moment where you pass into it, and you're not only on a TV set, you're on a TV set that is a recreation of the Enterprise, and then that goes away, and then you're on the Enterprise.
Literary Treks.
This is what I expect from the ongoing comics. This is kind of what I think we've wanted, is just to have this crew start to feel like the original series in some ways.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and get in on the daily Trek Talk. You find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, the Windows Podcast Directory for Xbox and Zune, or you can stream from the website. Just visit trek.fm/pd for podcast directory to get all the links. We had a message through the website, Chris CB Spock, he wrote in again, And he said, just listen to your spinoff episode. One of the spinoffs you missed was the original Galactica. There are references to Tilium and Ovians in Voyager. Also, another Alias reference was the Red Matter. In seasons 1 and 2 of Alias, Sydney was trying to steal a device that used Red Matter, and it even looked the same, like a giant red ball.
Yeah, I didn't know about the BSG one. The Red Matter, I mean, that's a, I don't know, I see that as a bit of iffy territory, because it's not, I don't know if it's necessarily supposed to be the same Red Matter, or if that's just a thing that he has running through his shows almost coincidentally, but yeah, I'm not sure. Not sure about that. Yeah.
Well, if you want to leave us a message and share your thoughts, just go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there, choose to send a show, and choose Standard Orbit. That'll come to both of us by email. You can also use the tab on any page to send us a voicemail using your webcam's microphone, and you can talk to us and other listeners in our forums at trek.fm/forums. In social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Twitter under username trekfm. Mike, where can people find you out of orbit?
You can find me right here on Trek FM doing commentary, Trek Stars. And for those original series people who may be interested, we did just talk to J.D. Payne and Patrick McKay, the writers of the new Star Trek movie. So go ahead and check that out. You can also find me on commentarytrackstars.com where I do commentary Track Stars off topic. And you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K.
You can find me on Twitter at 005, DOUBLEOFIVE, and you can find me guesting on various other places around the network. We've been getting some iTunes reviews, which is great, because reviews are very important to us. Not only because we love to hear what you think about the show, because it helps impact how we place in iTunes and Stitcher. Reviews make it easier for other Trek fans to find our shows. We know that it does take some extra time to visit iTunes and Stitcher to write the reviews, so as an added incentive to share your thoughts on our shows, we're giving away some great prizes as part of a month-long promotion. These includes a season of Star Trek, Your Choice, on Blu-ray or DVD, an official Starships collection ships from Japan, complete with Japanese magazine, Star Trek novels, and a full collection of our alien art badges. Winners will be drawn at random from all entries received before midnight Pacific time on July 31st. All you need to do to enter is leave a rating and review on iTunes and or Stitcher. You can only leave one review per show, of course, but you can review multiple shows and do so on both iTunes and Stitcher. And for each review, you will receive one entry into the drawing. Remember, you can also review the master feed, and that'll give you an entry as well. There are two steps for entering. Leave a review on iTunes and or Stitcher, and visit trek.fm/review and complete the form. We're looking forward to hearing from you, and thank you for your support. And also, before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor who helps us bring Standard Orbit to you each week, and that sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks with more than 150,000 titles to choose from, and new titles coming every week, from classics to current bestsellers and even some of the most famous Star Trek books like Prime Directive, Federation, and Spock's Worlds. Audible has something for everyone. Mike, what do you have for everyone?
Well, I have a book which I think we might have talked about before, but that was a while ago, so we can talk about it again. It's Star Trek: The Eugenics Wars, The Rise and Fall of Khan, Nooney, and Singh, which was written by Greg Cox, and it's narrated by Anthony Stewart Head, who was on, like, Buffy or something, right?
Oh, is it Giles? Oh my gosh, yes.
Yeah, Giles. So, here's the description. Even centuries later, the final decades of the 20th century are still regarded as one of the darkest and most perilous chapters in the history of humanity. Now, as an ancient and forbidden technology tempts mankind once more, Captain James T. Kirk of the Starship Enterprise must probe deep into the secrets of the past to discover the true origins of the dreaded eugenics wars, and of perhaps the greatest foe he has ever faced.
Himself. No.
Maybe. No. I think there's someone in the room who's actually read this thing. Thumbs up or thumbs down, Max?
Book two, thumbs down. Book one, thumbs up.
Book two, thumbs down. Book one, thumbs up. We're talking about book one here, and you can get that for free here on, well, since you listen to Trek FM, you can get it for free on Audible.com.
It's basically a Gary Seven story.
Is basically a Gary Seven story. I mean, come on.
This is the greatest moment of my life.
Yes, this is the greatest moment of Drew's life. Now he's just confused. anyway, okay. And you know what the greatest moment of our listeners' lives will be? When they get this book for free on audible.com.
That's right. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial just to see how great Audible is. So give it a try today. Catch up on all those classic Star Trek books you've yet to read and that latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we thank Audible for supporting Standard Orbit and Trek FM.
And we thank Max for the in-studio review.
Yes, we do. And also, Trek Fan. It's a great way for you to take your love of Star Trek and put it into action. At Trek Fan, you'll explore new places, learn new things, and collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles, complete real-life mission objectives, and win great prizes. Challenges include communications, engineering, and flight operations. There's internet relay chat, free books through Starfleet Academy, and much more. Best of all, it's absolutely free. Not just free to play, but completely free. Find out more by visiting fm.trekfan.org. Again, that's fm.trekfan.org. And remember to use this special URL so they know you heard about it here on Standard Orbit and Trek FM. So everybody, be sure to tune in next week where you can hear the last half of the commentary. And until then, thanks for listening. Have a good week and keep on trekking. It is the will of Landry.
Mr. Chekov, take us out of orbit ahead, warp factor 1.
Hi, sir.